and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I know our speaker tonight has got this thing. We're celebrating Tim Moore's 10th AA birthday tonight. So Tim Moore has been the man for the Monday night speaker meeting for quite some time. And I'm really glad that we had Harry agree to tell his story. He's one of our favorites. We're bringing him back one more time. I guess he's going to tell us who's going to win the bowl game tonight. He's probably got an opinion on that, because he has an opinion on just about everything, I think. Okay, Harry, you ready? Let's do it.
Okay, I'm not sure I like that introduction. I've got $25 on Alabama, and that's my only vested interest in the game. So if they win by 10, I'll have $25 more in my pocket. I used to bet a lot, a real lot, so I try not to do that anymore. My name is Harry, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 17th, 1991. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since then. Well, I found it necessary, I just didn't have one. Because I've been witness to too many things that happen when you do take that that drink, you know. I was listening to a story I told in 1996. It's so old it was on a cassette. And if you have a copy of that, I'd like that back. You know, I was 5 years gung-ho as hell about the program, doing everything I could to stay sober and try to help another alcoholic. And after I told my story, there was a gentleman that was part of my home group, the 11 o'clock meeting every day over here at this clubhouse, has been my home group for a good while. The guy by the name of Joe Phelan, after I told my story, he says to me, he says, son, he was 50 years sober. He said, son, you still have quite a bit of ego left. And when he said that to me, I did not like that. I mean, I'm saying, who is this old crotchety guy telling me that stuff? You know, because I was so into my sobriety. But I heard that tape, and he was absolutely right. I've had some people say some things over the year that were absolutely right. So I have a little bit of a cheat sheet. My wife, I asked her if she could remind me some of my stories, just in case I forgot some of them. I have to be prompted to remember something nowadays, because I really do have a bad memory. The last time I told my story at this clubhouse was in September of 2009, and I was just facing back surgery. And since then, I've had that surgery and another one. I had a stent put in, and then clinically depressed, crazy as shit. But that's a story I may get into or may not. I'm born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. Before I start, I wanted Tim to tell a story, because this reflects my relationship with Tim. I heard him tell the story. My memory is so bad that I cannot repeat it, so I'm going to ask Tim to come up real quick and tell the story, and then I'll get on with mine.
I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. AA ought never be organized, friend. The meeting, I got my white chip 10 years ago today. I don't remember anything that was said in that meeting. Harry loves this story, but it's really, of course, true. I don't remember one word that was said in that meeting, but I picked up a white chip. And after the meeting, the lady who gave me my white chip, her name was Grace. She was a mainstay at the Gwinnett Room in Lawrenceville. That's where I got my white chip. And many years of sobriety. Well, I was trying to get to my car without speaking to anybody, and she stopped me. And she's a real southern lady, sweet. You know, everybody loved her, sponsored a lot of women. She said, how you doing? Got my name and started talking to me. And she said, now, Tim, honey, she said, I remember it as clear as I remember what Harry was just saying. She said, I'm going to tell you how to be unique in Alcoholics Anonymous. said, you come to meetings every day, you get in that book, and you get you a real good sponsor. You tell him all your secrets. You tell him everything. You do everything just like they tell you to do in AA. Don't make any changes in your life the first year, and stay out of all the relationships the first year. And you'll be unique, because nobody in AA has ever done that. And she said, but now everybody's going to tell you that's what they did. But nobody has ever done that. We tell all the newcomers that. Said, but just, why don't you try this? Go, come back tomorrow. Get up in the morning. Ask God to keep you sober. And come back tomorrow. Talk to a few alcoholics. Read something. And if you make it tomorrow night, get down on your knees and thank God for keeping you sober and see what happens. I've got a lot of good advice in AA, but that's the best advice I've ever gotten. So, thank you, Harry.
Thank you, Tim. That story is just the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of truth in that story. Okay, I'm born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. I grew up, I moved to DeKalb County in 5 years. I grew up less than 5 miles from here. I went to a private Hebrew school when I was a youngster. It was a very, very good school. A lot of people who graduated school have gone on to do a lot of successful things and are, if I started naming names, there are big shots in the community that have done a lot of good. After I was in elementary school, where I was a tough kid, I already had the things that kids that are in trouble nowadays already had, you know, the compulsive obsessive disorder, ADD, you know, all of it. I don't know what it was, but later in life I found out what my particular problem was. But I thought I lost a watch today, and that's why I was late here, because I just couldn't give up looking for it. let's see where I was. So I had some behavioral problems at an early age. This one story I can tell. I drew a picture, or was credited with drawing this picture at something that looked like a you know pornography type of thing. You know, kid drawing a picture, and they said I did it, and blah blah blah. And I told my mom and dad just could not get over the fact that I did it, and they just were. They were very aggressive with me. I was very young, and they were quite physical with me. You could do that back then. And I kept saying, I didn't do it. And that is really the precursor of my life, because I did not do that. And eventually they found out that the young lady had drawn this picture, had nothing to do with me, and, you know, but I was already that guy that it could have easily been me. And I can't tell you in my life how many times I said, I didn't do it. I mean, you know, my whole life is I didn't do it. Now, I was listening to the story that I told, you know, about when I was 5.5 years sobriety. And it reminded me that when the two words that I that really were the big introduction to me for AA is that blame and excuse. And, you know, I had to get rid of those in my vocabulary. And I will just tell you tonight that there's no way I can tell you my story without some blame and excuse in it. But I don't mean any harm to anybody. And I was listening to the story, and I was telling some outrageous things, and I was using names and dates. And I'm not going to do that today. So I also want to say that right now I have been, in the past 6 years, this is the best I've felt in a long time. I'll get to some of that. I went on to high school, and of course I got to high school and I didn't feel like I fit in, because everybody that was in my high school class had been at the elementary school next door to the high school. So I came in from this little private school, didn't know anybody. I was a very, very short kid, and I automatically didn't fit in. I had a group of kids that, you know, were Jewish kids that I sort of hooked up with, and, you know, eventually they would become very close personal friends, but we played basketball at a place called the Jewish Community Center, so I was involved in athletics, but even though I was very small, I was pretty athletic. But my first year there, I did pretty good, and then somewhere along the line, I just start faltering off, you know, I didn't fit in, I was already starting to drink. and you know, just got away from the program. I dropped my eye on the ball, or how do you say that? I just was not going in the right direction, and it continued. It became a pattern in my life. Some stories when I was young is that my first time I really think I got high was in my neighborhood. All the kids would hold their breath until they got red in the face and almost passed out. And boy, I loved doing that. I mean, you know, I was a redhead, and boy, I got red. I was very light skinned. I got really red, but I really loved to hold my breath and exhale, and boy, the dizziness that came with that. My drinking really started around age 14. My father owned a grocery store in downtown Atlanta. I was born on top of that store. That store was located at the corner of Simpson and Sunset, and I bring that up only to say that was Coretta Scott and Martin Luther King lived on that street. That's where their home was. And so, you know, it was like the middle of the Civil Rights Movement that I was down there. And so, you know, I grew up hearing some of this stuff. My mom and dad really used to argue a lot. One other point I should bring up, and I used to think these things made me unique, but everybody's unique. But the other thing is that my parents were Holocaust survivors. And, you know, my mom was taken when she was 13 years old, and my father was in the work camps. And, you know, I don't think they knew too much about raising children, you know. But I knew what they did want, though, is they wanted the best for their children, and they may have pressed a little too heavy on me and my brothers. We all are unique in our own way. I was at my father's grocery store. I'd already been drinking. I'm already stealing a little money. I smoked my first joint in Montreal, Canada, at a cousin's wedding. My brother, who's 5 years older, and my other cousin up there let me smoke a doobie. And I smoked doobies from then on out for 20 straight years. And I ain't joking you. I have a witness to my story here today. I can tell you that I smoked reefer every day, all day long. I mean, saved all my roaches in my ashtray so I could re-roll them again. You know, nowadays you get caught with one roach, boy, they're ready to take you off to the big house. But, I mean, I'd have roaches in ashtrays so I could use them again. You know, get that good, sticky, gooey stuff. So I started smoking reefer then. Yeah, my friends and I were experimenting with drinking. My brother was was in a fraternity there, and so every week they drank a lot of alcohol, and so I ended up getting involved with grain alcohol because they used to mix it in grape juice called Purple Passion, and you know that worked for me because you know you can drink and get drunk, and you know didn't taste the alcohol. You just think you're drinking a grape punch, and I did that for quite a while. I grew up with a friend of mine named Mark S. He's been sober about 24 years. He was the first one that made it in here. But him and his brother Alan, which I know they don't mind me saying their names, but I mean Alan was just a cool dude. I mean he's 5 years older than us. He was hanging out with rock and roll bands. I mean you know there was a lot of music going on here. He looked like one of the Allman Brothers. And, you know, he wrecked cars, got high, chased women, and he was like my first sponsor in life, you know. So his brother and I wanted to be like him, you know. So, I mean, he was selling pounds of reefer, so we got to sell ounces of it. I graduated into Quaaludes. I was about 21 years old. That was a really tough time for me. I don't know if you know what Quaaludes are. That's a drug. I know one guy in the back knows what Quaaludes are. He has somewhat of a parallel story, but he is a musician. I got addicted to Quaaludes. I remember the first night I did Quaaludes, I said to myself, who would want to do this drug? You know, it was just, I was sick as a dog. And, you know, the next day I tried one, and boy, I loved it. You know, it just was the bomb. It was like drinking a bottle of alcohol without the alcohol. You know, it just got you there. It was a seductive drug. I never took ecstasy, but I think it had a parallel from what I understand with men and women having relationships. Then I graduated to cocaine, and I didn't like cocaine. I was listening to the story I told. I can't believe some things I said on it, but I will tell you that briefly, I should go back up. I was addicted to the Quaaludes, and my family didn't know what to do with me, so they put me on a one-way ticket to Israel. I had been in and out of some hospitals, and let's see, this is 1979 when I got there, so I was 25 years old already, couldn't stop doing Quaaludes, couldn't keep a job, and my family decided that they would send me to Israel. You know, it's kind of like what Jewish parents did when they didn't wanted to hide their children. You know, at that time, being gay wasn't as up to snuff as it is now, so there was a lot. When I got to Israel, I met a lot of Jewish gay kids and a lot of drug addicts. And, my drinking really took off in Israel because I no longer could have my Quaaludes. It took about 6 weeks in Israel for me to get even oriented. I got there. I went on an airplane with $500 in my pocket. I met this guy that was a high roller, and I hooked up with him. 2 days later, he's still high rolling, and I'm out of money. And so I went to this office and found the place that I can go for free, and it was called a kibbutz. And it's where people volunteer to help, and you work 6 hours a day, and they, you know, give you a place to live and stuff like that. And I really got into it big time. I really enjoyed myself there because I could work, and I was a good worker, and I had no responsibilities. I found the hashish, and I was drinking a lot of whiskey called Sheva Sheva Sheva, which is 3 sevens, but it's just like a shit brandy. And but I drank a lot of it, and I was smoking, and so sometimes I was a shepherd, so sometimes in the morning I would get up and milk sheep at 4 a.m. and clean this carousel. I mean, it was not, I got a picture of it, it was not an easy job. I was pushing this something you'd scrape a roof off with, and then afterwards I had to pressure wash it, and it had to be really sterile because the sheep could get diseases. And I did that every day, and I thought I was having a blast. You know, they loved me because they couldn't find anybody else to do that stuff. And but then later on in the afternoon, I'd go down to the fields where they were picking cotton, and I would sit on a tractor, and they'd pick some cotton, put it in this machine, and bring it to me, and I would take it to where it had to go, and I was just sitting on the tractor waiting around, and I was smoking hash. I mean, I was in paradise. It was good. And there was a lot of women from all around the world that were there because Israel is an attractive spot to get to. I forgot to mention that I was robbed at my father's grocery store when I was 16 years old. Somebody put a gun to me and pushed my father out behind the cash register. And that was an important part of my life because I almost did get killed. I mean, the gun was in my head. I got home while I was there. I wasn't scared. There was a gun sitting in front of me that I could have gotten to. These were two kids, 14 years old. I'm only 16 years old. Back then, there's no crack, but there's sniffing. Everybody was sniffing glue and doing some other stuff. And, I was on the phone talking to my little brother. He was asking for some cocoa and bread to bring home. So my family heard the robbery going on. So they called the police, and luckily the kids got out of the store before the police got there. I mean, who knows what would have happened. But while this deal was going down, I wasn't scared. It was about an hour later, and we just shoved it under the table at my house. It was never spoken about. It was not a thing. It was pretty traumatic, you know, when I look back at things. Well, the way my life turned out, it's, a lot of things were traumatic. So, let's see. I'm finished with Israel. I had a great time over there. I had my own little private place, which was really special for somebody that was a volunteer. And I would walk every day all the way up to the hill to take care of the sheep. And I would be drinking out of a bottle just openly. And, you know, they didn't like that. But for some reason, I was able to get away with a lot of it. Okay, we got good time. Okay, so I'm in this room. I went to Georgia State University, and I was trying to go through college over there, and I was good for the first 4 weeks, and then, you know, I'd go through that binge, and then it was excuses and, you know, why I couldn't do this and that, and it got to the point at the end that I would just, I wouldn't even look for refunds. I just gave up on the class. So, of course, I ended up with lower than 2.0 when I finally finished the deal. I remember one story that was, you know, me and Mark were on a run, and we had to have something done for this teacher, and I didn't do what I needed to do, so I came to class wrapped up in a cast. You know, I wasn't even hurt. I just wrapped myself on this cast and came with this boo-hoo story. And it just, you know, it just kind of tells us it's ridiculous. You know, this is what I found out now. You know, when I do stuff like that, people can see it. I can see it nowadays when people tell me what they're doing and it looks ridiculous. But back then, I didn't think they could see it. There was one other little story about that. I had an employee, or I worked with this guy at my family's apartment complex that they owned. Later after the grocery store. And this guy, we went to near the Atlanta Stadium. I didn't shoot dope. I have shot dope, but I wasn't shooting dope. But he said he could get some reefer, so I take him over there. And so he is doing a speedball, and I hit the person in front of me. Do not do any damage to this person's car, but just crush my little Datsun, just the whole front thing. And so I went back down to Georgia State and parked my car, told the police down there that somebody backed out and hit me. And the police said, well, where's the glass? You know, I mean, my whole front, there was no glass. There was no sign of an accident. But that's the kind of things I'd scheme up. You know, I was trying to protect myself, just looking stupid. I had a few other good times at Georgia State. There was a guy by name J.B. Stoner. J.B. Stoner was a real radical in the state of Georgia during the Civil Rights. What are those days called? Whatever. So, but he was thinking, he was at Georgia State speaking, and I was high, and I got up and grabbed that microphone out of his hand and just started screaming and yelling what a racist he was. He was talking against Nazis and black people, and I just got up and, I mean, today you just get thrown in jail right off the bat for that kind of stuff. I also was at a Harry Chapin concert at Georgia State on the plaza somewhere there, and so he was real popular at the time, and I was on stage high on Quaaludes, and he was singing a song, and I was up there just dancing around, just stupid as hell, you know what I mean? It's just amazing. So, but I didn't get put in jail that day. I went to Israel. I'll just finish up with this, because I got busted for hashish over there, and my drinking was getting real bad. So if I wasn't an alcoholic before I got to Israel, I was definitely an alcoholic when I got back. I was 210, that rosy face, bloated, and so when I got busted for the hashish, the farm I was on, as much as these guys loved me, they couldn't let me stay. But they took care of my thing over there. They paid my expenses to get out of jail, and they took care of me. And one of my proudest days of my life was the first day I was in this little jail in Afula, Israel. The American Embassy came out to see me to make sure that I wasn't being mistreated. And, you know, that's cool. You know, when you're in a foreign jail, not knowing what's going to happen, and you know what was even cooler is my family never found out about it. So I came back to Atlanta looking for fame and fortune. I had an uncle who died, and I thought I was going to get a piece of his estate. So I finally came home. It was always kind of my thinking. And I came back. I started working for selling furniture for a company called Levitt's. And then I worked for Haverty's, then I worked for Sturkey's, and then I found a job at a place called Roberts, and that's where I met Jeff. And, man, that was like the Wild West there. They didn't care whether you drink, drugged, whatever. As long as you produced sales, they liked you. It was a very fun place to work, a lot of people getting high. Let me see. I mean, every day was a story, just, you know, a story like that. I mean, it's just every day was just like, you know, my older brother used to tell me that I was like a cartoon character, you know, just just, you know, every day, you know, that addict, junkie, alcoholic, scheming, thinking thing. So, I mean, I could go on and on about stories like that. I had three DUIs. I got, you know, and if anybody wants to hear any more of this stuff later, just get with me. You know, but I mean, it was just one story after the other. One of my DUIs was a boating under the influence. And so I was up in Lake Lanier. My friend was 21 years old. We were doing Quaaludes. He fell out of the boat, almost drowned. I ended up falling into some, you know, to the bank in shallow water, and they arrested me. This was not even a motorboat. This was just a paddle boat. And they arrested me for a DUI. So, you know, and then I had one DUI. Back then, you can get DUIs. I mean, I got these three. I had three DUIs. This happened way when I was 21. When I came back from Israel in 1981, so I was about 27 years old, I had three DUIs within a 9-month period. So, I worked at a place, Levitts, that was a dry county. And so, not Levitts, Haverty's, at Southlake was a dry county. So every day I was drinking to go out there. I used to drink Wild Turkey 101, so I'd either have a pint or a half pint under my seat at all times. So I got fired from every job. This is the good part. I meet the woman of my dreams, she met me. We met in a furniture store. And we were up on the elevator going up, and in this store, Sturkey's, we drank every day also. I had befriended a gentleman that was very interesting, to say the least, and we used to just party together. I mean, he had friends that I didn't even know, you know, that kind of stuff. What a great story that I can't tell now. Dot walks into the store. We get on this elevator to go up the elevator, and she says to me somewhere along the line, have you ever lived out of the country before? Okay, well, I'm thinking to myself, what kind of question is that? You know, I mean, and then I'm starting to think in my head, well, how does she know? You know, I lived in Israel for a couple of years. Come to find out, she'd lived in Turkey and Germany for about 6 years. She was a traveler, and she just had this instinct that I might have been traveling. And we've been together ever since. It ain't been all pretty, but we have been together, and things are going really well. And I've got too many stories that I could tell about that, but I'm trying to be more, not put everything out on the street like I did when I was 5 years sober. I will just tell you that I am very grateful for Al-Anon. I think Al-Anon and her sponsor has kept us together. And, right now I'm trying something different to even make the relationship stronger. But let me talk a little bit about how I got in the sobriety thing. I was at Robert's drinking. I couldn't control my drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. I mean, I couldn't go to work. I mean, I had to make a decision, work, drink, work, drink. So I made a decision to drink, you know. And so I had my niece go out and clean out my 401k because I couldn't go anywhere. I was so just screwed up from drinking. And then somewhere along the line, this is just a 9-month period. From the time that I left my job being a roaring alcoholic, and I had a psychiatrist that put me on Anabuse, and I was trying to do this sober thing. And when I couldn't drink because of the Anabuse, this guy introduced me to crack cocaine. And I said, well, hell, let me try that. And I tried it, and I didn't stop trying it for 9 months. And I'm one of these guys, compulsive, obsessive. Anybody that knows anything about a crackhead knows that their job in life is to get the next hit. And, I mean, that's true with other drugs, but for some reason, the high is so quick on crack, you just got to have another one. And so that lasted for about 9 months. I tried to, I was in Linwood Park, which is not far from here, and I was trying to, I stopped at a one of these places where you stop and pick it up, and they gave me two hits and put it in my hand. I'd already gone through a ton of money. I mean, I went through everything I had, my money and some other people's money. And he gave me two rocks, put it in my hand. I tried to drive off. I had, I've always had a lot of golden retrievers. I've got three right now. We just put one down the other day, so four. And it's difficult to put your dogs down, but when they get old and they don't do, you know, you got to be respectful to the animal. But I had three of my dogs in the car, and the guys, when I start to drive off, just grabbed the key out of my ignition. And they just pulled me out of the car and beat the shit out of me. I mean, just, I used to wear Birkenstock sandals. And I mean, I know somewhere they're hanging on somebody's wall, you know, like antlers. I mean, so I took this major beating, and, you know, and I ended up in a hospital called Decatur Hospital. They had a doctor named Dr. Erlard. And this guy here had long hair. He was looked like Jesus Christ, I swear to God. And I was really, really sick. I mean, I had been physically beaten up. I was kind of, couldn't do dope, so I'm kind of like, don't feel that good about that part. And, you know, he said something to me, you know, and whatever it was, it just woke me up a little bit. And he said, they invited me. Now, I've been to other mental hospitals. Detoxes and, you know, Peachford and West Paces Ferry when they were around. So I'd already been to those. But he whispers in my mouth and something, and they want me to go upstairs to a program up there. And I said to him, I said, I ain't going to no program. I'd already been to some Cocaine Anonymous meetings and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was hearing the message that there was a solution to my problem. And while I was in the hospital, I made a decision to walk up out of my bed. I said, I'm going to try to do it this time. And things were different. I mean, I really had had enough. Everybody, Dot, my family, everybody was against the idea. They wanted me to stay upstairs. My first 12-step meeting after that visit to hospital was to a Overeaters Anonymous meeting. And I'm saying, why are you sending me here? And the truth being is all compulsive obsessive behavior, you know. So I was sitting there, and at the time I didn't think it was right, but it was the right thing for that moment. So with vigor I had never had before, I jumped into the fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, because at the time I thought the cocaine was my problem. But in reality, the alcohol has always been my problem, because that was always my number one. I didn't like cocaine, like I said. I had hooked up with a lady that dealt a lot of cocaine in Atlanta, so I had a period in my life that I did a lot of powder cocaine, and she'd give me these big empty baggies, 5-pound baggies, and I would scrape the stuff off of it and have these little can, these, you know, film holders full of cocaine, you know, everywhere I went. So it was good. She wasn't, she was really nice to me. And, you know, I was addicted to the cocaine, so we do what we do. Where am I at? Okay, I had this vigor. For the first time in my life, I actually did something for myself. I looked in the telephone book, and I found a treatment facility that had a 30-day outpatient program, and they would let me in on a sliding scale because they didn't have anything. And it was at Northside Hospital. And I went to that thing, and I actually finished it. I was there for 30 days. It's like one of the first things I've ever really completed. I've always dropped off before anything finished. And my father actually came down to interact for family day. My mom wouldn't do it because it was all my fault. You know, it was no disease concept in her life. Oh, I'll tell this one story because I know my sponsor likes this. I was up in Chattanooga smoking crack cocaine, and it was about 2:30 in the morning, and I have a big collection of Wild Turkey decanters, and I had one of my decanters, and my decanters were precious to me, but I had opened one and was drinking out of it, and I was smoking crack cocaine, and I really felt like killing myself. So I called my mom in Atlanta, and I say, Mom, listen, I'm really thinking about killing myself. And she said, quit calling this number, and hung up on me. So that was, you know, that was during that 9 months that I was doing the cocaine thing. this is, people were just falling off. Nobody was willing to help me, but they loved me, but they weren't willing to help me. So I'm going to Northside Hospital. My father comes to visit me. It was a big step in our relationship. And then I just, with enthusiasm, I got involved in Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was there for the deal. I mean, when I look back at it now, I was a cartoon character and that stuff. You know, I mean, I was just insane. I went to a CA meeting every night. I went to an AA meeting over here at 11 o'clock every day. I was working there at Roberts. I was helping my family after about a year in their business at the same time. And, you know, and Dot used to travel for business, so it all kind of worked out. And, I was heavily involved in Cocaine Anonymous. I had a sponsor that took me through the steps. I remember when I met my sponsor, I was looking at him, and I'm trying to decide. There was either one or two guys at this meeting that were the gurus of Cocaine Anonymous at that meeting. So I chose this one, and, sometime later, it was a long time after I'd been sober for a while, I found out that him and I were the same age, and he just, to me, looked so much older. But the truth of the matter, I was so immature. You know, when I got here, I acted like a 16-year-old kid. And over the years, after doing some step work and watching other people, as I got older, I started to grow into my age. And, but I worked the steps. I tried to live up to the steps. I was helping others. I started a recovery residence for recovering alcoholics. And at one time, I had as many as 60 people working there, and myself and a good friend of mine were the only ones that were taking care of it. We took care of the 60 guys, and I owned the property, so there was a lot of physical work. There was a lot of chasing alcoholics and drug addicts for money. It's difficult business at some time. And when I started at the beginning, it was not that difficult. It seemed like everybody I was involved with wanted, you know, they were like my age. They were contemporaries, you know. And, at the older I got, it just seems like they didn't want to think like I thought. You know what I mean? They didn't think that paying rent was important. And it is what it is. I don't think that I would have stayed sober if it hadn't been for the houses. I have spoke openly for a very long time. I've really had my stuff out in the street pretty wide open. And, I think I helped a lot of people with that. I know that we had a men's meeting, and I was going through a particularly difficult time. And, I mean, I know that for a year, every man in that group was glad they weren't me. And I think I helped a few of them by not wanting to be me. Have had some problems with other addictions. I had two surgeries, and if I have to be real about it, I definitely abused my pain meds and some of the other stuff I was taking. But I say my sobriety date is September 17, 1991, and I mean it. You know what I mean? Because I turned over a new way of life. And I was taking some high-powered drugs. I went into a violent depression. I was they diagnosed me bipolar, which I just saw a silver lining the other day. I went to see that movie before I came to talk about my bipolar a little bit. They diagnosed me bipolar, and I had been diagnosed that at 16. And my behavior, even in sobriety, was erratic. I was a ranting and raver. I mean, you know, I can tell you what, screaming at a junkie is more effective than trying to talk to him to make sense to him, you know. And I was that guy. I mean, I would rant and rave and get my hand up. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I almost got arrested, you know, trying to make people try to understand. I sponsored a lot of people. That's a lot of fun. I don't sponsor too much anymore. I've gotten a lot more quieter in the past 2 years. Not only did I have some surgery problems, but I had some devastating financial disaster in my life. My wife has been very patient, loving, and has been through a lot with me. That's why I'm so grateful today, because I'm doing okay. I was taking drugs like lithium. I was actually on such a high dose of lithium that I went to a neurologist because they thought I had early onset Parkinson. I was shaking a lot, and I still take medication for the shakes. I took a drug called Geodon. That drug is, to me, was the most dangerous of all the drugs for me, even though the other one made me, stupor. This drug here made me think about wanting to hurt myself. Now, I know that's not true for everybody else. That's just my personal experience. And, I know this is not AA and professional medical, but this is me. So I'm just sharing my experience. This may not be for everybody. But today, I think a lot of the suicides that are out there are from people taking medication in a trial period without any supervision. I had a friend of mine that went to the psychiatrist. The next day, he killed himself. There's got to be a parallel to that, because I only say that because I experienced that myself. Now, I'd never thought about killing myself, really. It was always a desperate cry, but I just remember thinking that, well, if I kill myself, my wife will get $1 million. I won't have to deal with the shit no more and stuff like that. And sometimes I'd wander around my Wild Turkey bottles thinking, well, if I did that, that would definitely be the end of it all. The combination of everything. But I was able to stay and not do it. And I also want to say that I had a number of people during that period of my life that were strongly there for me. Tim was one of them. A couple other people in this room were just by my side. They were very supportive. I never left AA. So it was very embarrassing sometimes. I'd crawl up here like this, part of it for surgery, but part of it for my depression. But I dragged myself to a meeting. I used to come to the 7:30 meeting over here, and they would sing, "Getting to Know You, Getting to Know All About You." And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I'm just new here. I don't want to hear this crap. I don't want you to know everything there is to know about me. It was so difficult to hear that. At one time, I was so sick, I'd watch football games and thought that just didn't feel like the people that didn't play in the game were being treated fairly. I couldn't watch Criminal Minds or Law and Order, which are two of my favorite shows, because it was so gruesome, I was actually fearful and scared. That's not how I think, so I know that was the meds and things like that. So, but in February, about a year and a half ago, this February will be 2 years, I sought some help, and I got a new psychiatrist. And lo and behold, about 3 weeks later, I was starting to act different. So I'm real grateful for some people that made me do what I had to do, and it turned out the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was addicted to my psychiatrist. It got to the point that I was so whacked that I'd call him and see him 3 times a week. Now, I don't blame him. I don't blame anything on anybody. But I'm telling you, sometimes you really have to listen to yourself when you're doing things. I worked the steps diligently. I took a lot of people through the steps, which is even, if you're here and you actually work the steps and get involved with other people and start taking them through the steps, a fellowship will grow up around you. You'll have a better understanding of the book. I'm not real big on the God thing, because I kind of feel like I don't believe in an afterlife as I stand here now. So because of that, I feel like it's hard to say, but I definitely believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have faith that everything's going to work out okay. I didn't feel that way for a long period of time. Staying sober is the greatest show on earth. But if you want to enjoy this show, you got to be here. I was here for so long and so hard that when I came upon hard times, I'm able to deal with this stuff. I have relationships with people. I got a sponsoree that actually sponsors me now. I call him. We've been talking every day now for 7 or 8 years. Every day. And, it's a great relationship. You got to get involved here to make this thing work. There's all different types of service work. You're going to see so much pain and misery here. But if you don't see it, you don't believe it. You just don't believe it. Then one other thing I would just say is that, it's nice to go to other meetings. Don't make one place your place. Because I have had people that I've worked with that make the one place their place, and if they go out of town, they don't feel comfortable. I mean, you know, when I go out of town, I used to go to a lot of out-of-town meetings. I used to travel a lot, and I would always run into people that I'd go to this new meeting, and they wouldn't even say hello to me. You know what I mean? Your first impression, well, how come they're not greeting me? Don't they know who I am? And, you know, but that's just the way it is. People don't really greet the newcomers a lot, so be mindful of that if you've got some time. And so I'd go to a lot of meetings, and I got to be comfortable. So I have a second home in Florida, and it looks the way things are going. I should be down there within the next year to 2 years, living down there full time. But I have a home group. I have a sponsor down there. I've got a couple of his sponsorees that are part of my network. So I'm prepared for the move. Oh, good. I'm going to leave time for a question and answer period. Well, let me look at this real quick. Just tell you some fun stories. But Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. I believe I've been of good service to the fellowship, and I believe, without boasting, that other people's lives, because of my ability to get sober in this program, are better off for my path in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say that with humility and a lot of personal pride. I was in Acapulco at the La Brise, which is a fancy hotel. They got their own private little swimming pools. And I was in the private swimming pool. I was drinking so much, I was drunk as hell. My ass, I was out there naked. My ass got burned so bad that when I got on the airplane to come back to the United States, because I had to have that last little bit of sun. You know, it wasn't enough that I was burnt like a crisp, but I had to stay out there that last 10 minutes, you know. And I thought I was going to die on the airplane. I had some real burns. I went up the road to Atlanta with a friend, and it was raining, and I slid down these hills with rocks naked. I mean, I had a guy that was locked up in his family's trailer doing cocaine. I'm on Quaaludes, and we're just coming down Road Atlanta, these hills, butt naked, on rocks, glass, everything, you know. I was real drunk shooting the hooch, and that was with Dot. And that was really, really close to when I met her. It was like the next day. And we left the raft, and because we just couldn't drag everything, and the cooler and the raft were stolen. When I was in Alaska, I drank on Anabuse. I never believed I could give up alcohol. I just didn't think that could happen. I ranted and raved when things didn't go the way I wanted it. I mean, that's sober. And that's part of my disease of the bipolar. And I take responsibility now for that disease. It is what it is. I'm being treated for it. I've never been at so much peace personally. I don't scream and yell anymore. I'm not quite as effective as I used to be. But it's healthier for me. Okay, she got the other stories I got. Jeff, you got a story for me? So, it's nice to have somebody that knows you as an alcoholic and a drug addict. I mean, sitting right next to you, because you know that they know the truth. You know what I mean? Y'all don't know me from Adam and Eve. But I got somebody that knows me in my old life, and he could sit. If you want to hear some good stories, talk to him after the meeting. But I'm just so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful that Tim is part of my life. And Connie, they've both been special to me and my wife. I am really grateful for Al-Anon and my wife's sponsor. Al-Anon's a good thing. I just say this, though. You know, if you're trying to get sober and the people around you are not up for that, your chances of staying sober are slim. You know, the people around you, if they love you, they need to understand that this is where you have to be to get well. That this you have to make this part of your life. And so it's good. I'm happy. I'm healthy. I'm whole today. I found a solution to my back pain for the time being. And life is good. Thank you.
Thank you, Harry. Life is good. Isn't it, everyone? Absolutely.
Thanks, Bill. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. This is a great night, and really over the top. Thank you very much, Tim. And Mark was my first sponsee. Bob Meadows hooked us up. And Harry, I love you. And I was trying to think, why do I know I love Harry, but I explain it to people why I love Harry. Now you know. But I remember Harry, of course, he just hit the top of the wave on some things he's been through, and Fred knows a lot more than I know. But, you know, I love Harry, and I knew he was going through some tough times. And a couple of times, this was years ago, I'd say, well, Harry, as long as you don't drink. And he was shocked. I wouldn't even bring up. He said, well, I don't want to drink. He's like, I've said, first, don't go fly an airplane. He's like, what's that got to do with what's going on here? And what I've learned through that is he made a decision. The book talks about many resolutions, but never a decision. And that's why I love him so much, because regardless of what's going on, that decision's been made. And I want to be around people like that. That's the kind of person I want to be. And this meeting is great. Tim's done great things with it. So many people here. And, you know, I really feel like NABBA would not let me fail. That's the best way I can describe it. You know, because I come in, you know, wobbling around, and people say, you're not going anywhere. Stand up, you're right here. Everything's going to be okay. And I really have walked on the shoulders of giants. And it's just amazing. And, you can't pay that back. You know, you run up a tab here, I have. You can't pay that, but I want to try as best I can. So, thank all of you for this.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.